You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Friday, Mike McNamara with you. Now that I don't watch the NFL anymore, I got a lot more free time. Joining me is the Gunner. The Mike. How you doing?
Yeah. Right, good. You?
I just played a bunch of audio from the Road to 9/11. Yeah. A lot of people want to thank you for turning them on to that. It's a nightmare, and I played, there's probably about four different cuts, ranging from anywhere from 30 seconds to a few minutes. But anyway, first one was the Bush administration comes in after their election, they get a counterterrorism brief, and Richard Clark says they looked at us like we were crazy. They had never heard of Al-Qaeda, although they had heard of bin Laden. They'd never heard of Al-Qaeda, and they weren't sure why this counterterrorism thing was so big. Then in the summer of 2000, a year and a month probably before September 11th happens, the CIA people say that the system is blinking red. We know something's going to happen. It's the United States. It's going to happen in the United States. And you hear that. And I go back to my question to Mike. Now, Mike, was this like onesies and twosies buried in the stack of other stuff? And Mike's response was, oh, no, no. And then kind of footnoted the point about how enraged the FBI still is that the CIA doesn't share the best leads they have, which is two Al-Qaeda guys coming to Los Angeles, staying in San Diego, and the FBI doesn't learn about them. And then finally, the piece of Mike, actually that spawned the whole conversation, was Mike saying, when you hear how Iraq comes up in this conversation, your head's going to explode. And I said, what do you mean? He said, right, it's like Tourette's syndrome. They're discussing one thing, and Rumsfeld blurts out, Iraq, we got to bomb Iraq.
It's like a stupid miniseries, a comedy miniseries that you would think that, you know, like some clown that's a comedian would say for a comic relief, you know, like, oh, let's go after, what do they have to do with anything? They don't. Let's just do it. You know, the American people are so stupid, they'll buy anything.
And what's amazing though, and about this documentary is the people that are in it and they go on the record are not people. There's one author in it. Everybody else is part of this. There is Richard Clark, who's a counterterrorism guy at the White House. There is a deputy director of the CIA, Leon Panetta. And when you hear the story about Rumsfeld, you hear Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's like Joe Dunford going on TV and saying, yeah, this is what he said. Now, that doesn't happen very much. And so you watch it and you just, you know, and so then the president says, yeah, well, we got to deal with Afghanistan first. And Rumsfeld looks at Shelton and says, hey, keep the planning going. Hey, keep the planning going on Iraq. We don't want to shut that off. Like, are you kidding me? So anyway, so I shared that audio with the audience here the last hour, and I got a couple of emails saying that I had no idea that the light was blinking that brightly and that they actually knew. So on September, another email I just got says this. So when I see the video of Bush in the classroom and somebody comes up and whispers to him and you see the look on his face, that is a look of, oh my God, everything that they've been telling me is happening. That isn't the look of what the fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. That's the look. that, oh my God, they were all right, and it's happened. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting. Here's one more email about it. Mac, I think the FBI has every reason to be ripshit about this. Kind of interesting that the CIA guys involved in it didn't have anything to say about it. What a bunch of idiots.
Of course. I mean, what do you want them to say? Yeah, we dicked that dog.
Yeah, we were trying to turn
it. We were really screwed the pooch looking back, man. That one was our bad. Yeah. No.
Yeah, no comment.
If you ever meet a politician or a government employee of that magnitude that admits that he was wrong, he doesn't belong. He doesn't exist. There's no such thing. They don't do that. So when people, if someone ever told me, said, "Hey, I met this politician who admitted he's wrong," I'd say, "You're lying." There's no such creature. They don't do that. It's not. It can't get those words out. Not in the vocabulary.
Yeah, and as I said, I think it's still available on the History Channel until October 11th. And then it was originally produced by the A&E Network, which has the rights. I guess they lent them to the History Channel to air it. And at some point, those rights go back to the A&E Channel. So that's why it's on the History Channel right now. But I would tell you, if you want to, it's three episodes. I think each one is either 30 or 60 or 90 minutes. Absolutely watch it. Absolutely watch it. I think you'll find it fascinating. So as much as it pissed me off to watch it, Mike, thank you very much. The Vietnam series wrapped up last night, and you sent me a text earlier that said that you were crying like a baby. Talk to me about it.
Man, I think that was probably the most difficult episode to watch. You know, have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and man, it just, you know, when everything kind of came together and you listen to these guys, Musgrave and all these other guys talk about this, and they kind of go more into the human. And then the aggravation of, you know, what we did. I think the thing, Mac, that really kind of bothered me the most that watching this whole series is, and again, the grains. You know, you go overseas and you believe that America is the best place on earth. We say it. And America is the greatest nation on earth. But then when you look at it through the lens of, let's say, South Vietnam, and you look at and you try and pull anything out that makes America look great, you can't. You know, we lied to them. We deserted them in their time of need. We made promises that we didn't keep. We cut off the money. We killed people because we didn't intervene. You know, and all of these things. And then the thing that killed me, the thing that really kind of choked me up was the fact that after all of those things that we did to those people, they still forgave us. And, you know, they came to this country, and it was hard for them to get here, a lot of the refugees. But when they did, you know, when they talked about it, made a point that there's no other ethnic group than the Vietnamese people, the refugees during Vietnam, that were more devoted to being Americans. They were more devoted to be business owners and entrepreneurs and to give back to America. Because what America had done for them, they forgot all of the horrible things. It was overwhelming. I walked away with that. How horrible do I feel? And I wasn't there for that. And imagine what these guys felt like. And Musgrave talked about it. And he couldn't get through the sentence without the emotion getting to him. When he was talking about, you know, looking back and talking, you know,
He was talking about when, what was he talking about when people were celebrating? Mike, what was he talking about? Do you remember he was talking about celebrating and they called him? Was it when we actually withdrew?
Oh yeah, when we withdrew, and a buddy of his called him and they were like, "Hey, celebrate." And he was like, "Why? What are you talking about? Celebrate what?"
everything we fought for, everything we died for, there's no reason to celebrate.
Yeah, you're going to celebrate the loss of 58,000, Americans. But what? You know, that's the whole, yeah, that was tough. That was a tough episode to watch. The Vietnam Wall part there, man, that one guy's testimony where he condemned the wall. He called it a black piece of stone in the ditch and it wasn't worthy of this and worthy of that. And then one day someone sent him an etching of his roommate or somebody. And then so he visited it. And like you said, I go back every year. I can't stop. You know, and if you've never been there, I think me and you talked about this. You don't have to been in the military. In the military. Didn't have to be in the Vietnam War. You know, when you come and you see that, you take that in, and you see this black monolith, in the shape of a triangle on this grounds, and as you're looking at it, and as it starts to come into view, you see this white, black and white, and you see these small white everywhere. And you can't make it out yet, but as you get clearer and your eyes focus, you notice their names. And then your hand scans across all of those solid black marble, and you see all of those names, and the names are probably what, half an inch? They're not big.
Yeah, I'd be curious to find out. I want to say that they're an inch. If you would ask me,
yeah, maybe they are. But they're small. But you see a panel, and the panel, in some of those cases, they're 12, 14 feet tall. I mean, it's remarkable what this does to you. And
when was the first time you saw it?
Probably when I was in the Marine Corps, I found myself in D.C. and I went over there. I was young. The Vietnam War didn't resonate with me. I didn't really have any. It was kind of like, okay, yeah, it was a war. I learned a little bit in boot camp. They talk about Vietnam vets, and when I came in, there were still a lot of Vietnam vets in.
Right.
And I remember looking at the ribbons. And you can see, the Vietnam campaign and Vietnam service and Vietnam Cross of Gallantry. It was kind of reminiscent, you're like, oh, okay, those guys are Vietnam guys.
Right.
But in that time, when I came in, it was still kind of that, hey, don't talk to me about the Vietnam War. That was Vietnam. This is now. This is the 80s. This ain't Vietnam. We're never going to fight a war like Vietnam again.
Right.
And those were from the guys that didn't serve there. And again, little do you know, yeah, we're never going to fight a war like Vietnam again, but we're going to fight wars like Vietnam again. And to understand that is, yeah, we're not going to Vietnam. We're not going to be in that environment. We're not going to those kind of people. But we're going to do the same thing again. If we don't learn from what we did then, we're going to do it again. And guess what? We did. And guess what? We're going to do it again.
You know what, Mike? And you know who's the next one that's going to get screwed by us? Are the Kurds.
Yeah, the Kurds are going to be the new South Vietnamese.
Yeah.
We're going to turn our back on them because they're no longer, it's no longer a viable solution. I mean, we don't need them. And, and that's why I say, Mac, I love this country. Man, I love this country more than life itself. And you know me, and when I say this, that if Mother America called for my name to be laid down at the altar of sacrifice, I'd do it. And I would have done it. And I would have done it gladly. But what tears at me is what we do and what we're perceived as by other nations. We're not that great. Again, we're going to do something to the Kurds. And I have the utmost respect for those guys. If anybody in Iraq, the Shiites and the Sunnis or the Shias, the Kurds to me they're the embodiment of what Iraq needs to be.
Right.
And again, we're going to turn our backs on them.
Since we went there, they're the most stable. They're the most pro-American. They have been our partner every step of the way. And now because, the problem is if they lived out in the West, nobody would care about them. Okay. They'd be left alone, but they sit on top
of Turkey.
Yeah. They sit on top of oil. That's the problem with the Kurds. And so we have a problem. We have a NATO ally, Turkey, that is becoming more fundamentally Islamic and closer to Russia. They have told us, yeah, an independent Kurd nation is not going to happen. And now we have Iraq saying, yeah, they just shut down, I think today, flights into the airport in Erbil. And they said, yeah, we're not having that. And the Kurds just voted, I think, 92% in favor of in their referendum on independence. So now what? Do we turn our back on the best partner we've had in Iraq because of, you know, our true partner is the government of Iraq? And
Turkey's never been our partner. You know, we're going to turn our backs on a nation that has been loyal, or a group of people, not a nation, but a group of individuals, the culture that has been so loyal to us, that has believed everything we've said. They've sacrificed their youth, you know, and we're going to walk away from them.
Well, you know, in my opinion, I think, and Mike is great friends with Jerry Durant, and Jerry's been on this program talking about how now the Iraqis believe that they won't ever be one nation again, and more, and so in my opinion, what the United States ought to force is a political solution in which there won't be an independent Kurdish state. There will be three provinces in Iraq. There will be a Sunni, a Shiite, and a Kurdish province. They will have a revenue sharing agreement relative to the oil. And that is the only way that thing is going to go forward. It is anything else is not going to work. And so to me, the United States has an opportunity to force that. And because you can say, look, to the Turks, they're not independent. They're part of Iraq. Right. And then to the Iraqis, look, you know that if you want the killing to stop, you know that you have to divide this nation up. You have to undo what the Brits did, you know, when they put it together with some stupid ass with a pencil that didn't know anything about the region and said, oh, this is just like Czechoslovakia. Yeah, those two groups, they don't go together. OK, you don't know that because you're stupid. Right. We're going to undo that. And I think the same thing needs to happen in Iraq. And the question is, does the United States have the credibility? Does it have the, you know, to do something that is, you know? And so to me, Mike, as I was watching that, the height of the letters on the Vietnam Wall are 5.53 inches. So you were right, a little bit more than half an inch.
Yeah.
They
seem bigger, though, don't they?
You know what? I was going to say that. I thought they would be closer to an inch because, yeah, they do. They absolutely do seem bigger. I told a story about the first time I went. I'd gone back to go to OCS. I had a flight contract. And so you show up, I think, on Tuesday. You go through your flight physical. They cut you loose Friday. And then you come back and you actually report to OCS on Monday. So went up to D.C., got a hotel room with another guy. We went out running. He's a cross-country runner at Texas Tech. Now, so he's going to go run 15 miles. I'm like, yeah, good luck, bro. So I cut through the mall. And, you know, the first time you go, it sneaks up on you. It's not this kind of like Washington Monument or Jefferson Memorial that's huge out of the ground. You have to go look for it to find it. And if you're not looking for it, you won't see it. And so I'm looking for it. I get to the Lincoln Memorial, and I'm looking, and I kind of see where it is. And I walk over, and you're absolutely not prepared for what happens to you, all right? And you go down the walkway, and at the entrance, you know, on each side, there's a catalog with names. And I would look for a name. I flipped through it to look for a name of a guy who lived down the street from me that was killed probably in 65 or 66. And for me, it was the first time the Vietnam War came to my home. And it was his last name is Lumley. I think his first name, if I recall, is Rick. And he was killed. I remember that the olive drab green army car with the yellow writing on the door being in front of the house. And I remember my mom was making dinner in the middle of the day. And I remember asking my mom what she was doing. I said, "Mom, what are you doing?" And she said, "I'm making dinner." I said, "Why so early?" She said, "Well, I'm taking this down to the Lumleys." She looked at me. She said, "Their son was killed in Vietnam." And I said, "Is that why the car's there?" And she said, "Yeah." And so, you know, like, you can watch it on TV. All of a sudden, a guy who used to be in your neighborhood, he's not coming home anymore. And so I remember looking up his name and then walking down. And what you're so unprepared for is you're looking at the names and you're going down and down and down. And it just keeps going down forever until you get to the bottom. And at the bottom, it is 10 feet, 3 inches tall. And you're at the bottom of it looking up, and all you see is names. And your sense is, oh, my God, this is what a war is. All these young men and women who, every one of them a different story, from a different town, from a different family across this country, who aren't coming back. Right? And then you think, after you watch the documentary, you know, there's 58,000 on that wall. And the estimates are in Vietnam, what, Mike, 2 million people?
Yeah.
All right, you divide 2 million by 58,000. And the Vietnamese could put up 34.5 of those walls for the people that were killed in Vietnam. That's just but it is. It takes your breath away, literally, when the first time you go.
That wall would extend from D.C. to Georgia.
Yeah. No kidding. I mean, if you put 2 million names on it. So it's just amazing. And it was interesting. You know the Vietnamese guy? He's a writer with the blonde hair?
Yeah, the blonde hair, yeah.
I'll tell you what a cool dude that guy is. You know, he talked about when he came home, like he had not written a letter to his mother in, what do you say, Mike, like 5 or 6 years?
6 years.
And he comes home and...
Shows up on the doorstep.
Yeah, they don't celebrate because... Other people that live in the building had 6 sons, and all of them were killed in the war. And so celebrating would have been impolite, you know? And
yeah, well, that is, I mean, we did not understand the Vietnamese people. You know, to say that they were, you know, third world country and things like that, I think, yeah, it was a big underestimation of, they showed us what courage was, what, you know, everything that was good, they showed it to us.
Yeah, you know, early in the series, I think it's John Paul Vann, they ask him about what's he think of the Viet Cong. And he said, "I wish I had a battalion of them. They can fight." They can fight. And you're like, what the hell did he just say? And in the last episode, Mike, anything, what had the most impact on you?
I think what I just talked to you about was the fact that, you know, that whole understanding of, from the Vietnamese side of the people, what they went through. You know, for us to turn our backs on them and walk away.
Yeah,
how about
the helicopter pilot? That one helicopter pilot jumping out of the helicopter as he turned it and flipped it the other way.
Yeah.
The craziness, you see the helicopters being shoved into the water and because there's just too many on the flight deck, and they just start shoving them off. And then you see this guy who must have been a helicopter pilot who flies, you know, by himself. And it's just, you're watching it going, you got to be kidding me. Holy shit. The other thing I found odd was the whole thing on the rooftop with the Marines that were finally left at the embassy. And their radio ran out of juice. And so they didn't know if anybody was coming back for him. There's no officers there. There's what? He was a master sergeant.
Yeah, the Matt Sargent was the last one.
Yeah, Matt Sargent and his detachment of guys. And no, it's just you're just watching it going, wow. And then they don't destroy all the classified information. And so that falls into the hands of the Vietnamese, and then those people are some of them are killed, and then the re-education camps. A guy came to this guy comes to do my DirecTV stuff a few months ago, and so we're talking, and you know, he sees my Marine stuff. And, you know, he says, you're in the Marine Corps. And I said, yeah, I just retired a couple of years ago. And he said, I'm Vietnamese Marine. And so I said, what's up, Devil Dog? And he started laughing. He said, yes, I Devil Dog. And so we're talking. 9 years in a re-education camp.
Yeah. One guy spent 17 years.
Yeah.
And he's only supposed to be 3 days for an enlisted guy. And I came out for an officer.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, I don't, so let me ask you this, and we'll get them on and ask them. Do you think Vietnam guys feel good about the way that story was told? Or do you think it opens up old wounds? Or do you think it's a combination of both?
The ones that I've talked to here, they're trying to watch it. And they've all give me, like, you know, yeah, this was a good story. And it told the truth, so.
Wow. Wow, that's a little bit surprising. No, you know what? I don't think it is surprising. I think if you're a documentary storyteller and you do it like I think Ken Burns does it, you don't tell the story. The people that were there tell the story. Your job is just to include all the elements of the story. And I guess to the extent that you don't do that, you can be faulted as a documentary maker. But I thought, and from the different guys that I've spoken to, the one word they used was balance. Let me just tell you what I thought was jaw-dropping that I didn't know about. And that was, I didn't know that Jane Fonda did the stuff that she did. I'd seen the photo of her sitting on the anti-aircraft gun. But the radio broadcast that she did, where she called them war criminals, and they should probably be executed, you don't come back from that.
How she
doesn't get up every day apologizing to them is beyond me.
Well, they had that one woman on there that was an anti-war activist, and when she saw the ball, she couldn't say she was sorry enough.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool though last night.
Yeah,
and she talked about the things that she had said, and the only thing that she could say was she was sorry. Right, and she's crying, and she said it again, and she said, "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that to them." But you know, and one of the things she said, but I was young and stupid too. And so I don't know. My own opinion is, I thought that it was characterized by balance. And I thought he represented the kaleidoscope of different perspectives. I thought he did that. I thought he did that pretty well. And everybody I thought he had speak, you didn't have anybody who was bombastic. You know, the guys who spoke from the North Vietnamese perspective were composed. Like the blonde-haired dude, when you first see him, you're like, who's this dude, man? He must be a different cat, because there's not too many blonde-haired Vietnamese dudes rolling around. And yet he was, like, he's one of the coolest guys in the whole thing. Everything he says, you can tell it's from his heart, and it's based in truth. And he thinks about, I think last night he was talking about the surrender, ultimately, of the South Vietnamese forces and how much animosity that South Vietnamese people feel towards the guy. I think he was the deputy, but then the president left. And he surrendered. And he said, but if he doesn't surrender, all those people are probably dead. If they fought us, you know, we had 18 divisions. They had six, and they were running out of ammunition. They would have been slaughtered. And so pretty cool. What else? Anything else about it that is on your mind?
No. What I said, I think, is everything on my mind.
Yeah. So you and I were talking. Where are they now? So Musgrave works for the VA? Is that what I saw at the end?
Yeah, he's doing something with guys returning from combat.
That's cool and appropriate. I don't know. You know what? He's I think one of the interesting guys in the thing because of his journey from being, you know, at Contien and fighting wounded, coming home, you know, kind of becoming a hermit, and then becoming, you know, somebody in the anti-war movement, in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and then going to work for the VA. He's an interesting dude. He's an interesting dude through the whole thing. His story pretty compelling.
Yeah.
And then what about, and what's that, there's another Marine by the name of Harris, and what's he do? What did he came back and, you know, what did he come back and do?
I have to look. I think it was something to do with schools.
And he's a Boston guy. Did he go back to Boston?
Yeah, he's on the East Coast somewhere. I'm not really sure.
Interesting. Here's an email for you. Do you think there will ever be anything like this made about Iraq and Afghanistan?
I don't know. That would be tough to watch, dude.
You know what? I think Mike's point is kind of interesting because it's not like we were texting during the show or anything, but I think that Mike's point is my point. What made that really hard to watch for me was as I'm watching that, I'm thinking about Iraq and Afghanistan. And this 9/11 audio is in my head. And I just, how do we not learn the lessons? How did we not, from all of this, how did we not learn the lessons to not get into wars that have clearly defined objectives? How do we not do that? And it just, you know, and we're involved in two of them that are, what would you call them? And there's no easy out in either. There's no easy out in either one of them. You know, in Afghanistan, we're going to be there a while in order to stabilize the nation and continue to build the military. But that sounds a lot like Vietnam, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, and then in Iraq, you know, we're back at the same place we were. Iraq now has the opportunity to rebuild itself for the third time. Can they do it right? What's going to happen with the Kurds? Are we going to go through it again? And what should we say to them to say, look, if you want continued American help, this is what you need to do. And if we say that, will they say, go to hell? We're okay with the Iranians. And then what does that do to everything we tried to do in that region? It's just a shit sandwich of gargantuan proportions. And as we were talking earlier, the Kurds appear to be the next people that are going to be screwed over in this folly of American foreign policy that we keep screwing up. So I don't know. That was the thing that I guess my biggest takeaway is after all of that, and I guess what irritates me the most is Powell is a Vietnam guy. Colin Powell is a Vietnam guy. Right? Rumsfeld is of that era. Okay, he lived through that, and so, right. And so, how do we not? How did you think that you were just going to go to Baghdad, turn this government over, and then walk away? You know, how did you? Come on, you know. So anyway, hold on. Here's an email. The Vietnam War PBS Facebook page is posting some really good things on the background of Burns' project. Today I read about the planning and the decisions about music they chose. Really good stuff. Check it out. I'll do that. So it's PBS, Vietnam War PBS on Facebook. So check it out. You know, again, I can't imagine what it would be like to be in a production meeting with Mike sitting there, me sitting there, and then the other people, and say, okay, which of these storylines have to be in it, and where can we not go? Because we simply can't develop the subject line. I mean, the stuff that I'd be curious to hear Ken Burns say, what is not in there that you wished you could have put in there? There must be some interesting decisions that they had to make based on time that PBS gave them, and money and production time. And again, this, I think, 10 years in the making. 10 years in the making. And so, so pretty interesting. Another email. Mac, I heard you guys talking, I believe, yesterday. Is Gunner's dad watching it? Mike, your dad watching it?
I would probably say no. Probably not. He's not really a big TV guy, but I mean, I know he knows it's on. I'll talk to him about it and ask him.
Mike, just tell everybody, your dad was in Vietnam. What years? What was his rank? Where was he?
He started out with Mike Company 3-1, and I want to say late 67, early 68, and then was with Kilo 3-5. In his last years, because Mike 3-1 rotated back into that time, so they all went to Kilo 3-5.
He's a Kilo 3-5 guy.
Yeah.
Wow. He and Patrick, they can go out drinking then. Yeah. They know the handshake. The interesting. Here's another one. Mac, Vietnam veteran here. In spite of some things that I would quibble with based on my own personal experience, I think the body of work was incredible. I think it did do a balanced job. I was extremely worried about how they would treat My Lai, and that the documentary would devote an extended amount of time to that. It did not. And I have to tell you that I was astounded by that. It covered it, but it didn't give it any more weight and credibility than it did a number of other things that happened during the war. I think that in and of itself is huge, that My Lai was a episode, but it didn't define everybody's experience, unlike When We Came Home. Hats off to Mr. Burns for his balance. I most enjoyed the two perspectives that we don't tend to get here in the United States, and that is the one from the North Vietnamese / Viet Cong perspective, and then from the South Vietnamese civilian. I would echo what Gunner said a little bit ago. How those people still love us blows my brains. But they do. They love the United States. I wish every good thing for the Vietnamese people as a nation, and also for the Vietnamese people that came to the United States. They are wonderful people. They are hardworking. They are disciplined. And they love the United States in spite of everything that we did to them. God bless them. God bless Mr. Burns. I've enjoyed also the people you've had on. It's interesting to hear Mike talk, being raised in the shadow of Vietnam, by a Vietnam veteran. Enjoy the program. Have a great weekend. I don't watch the NFL anymore either. Sundays now got a lot more enjoyable. Interesting. I agree with all that. You know, I have, you know, Vietnamese people that live across the street. Costa Mesa, there's a sign up that's called Little Saigon. And a friend of mine who's a Vietnam veteran told me that that sign used to get torn down all the time when they first put it up. He said, you'd come by. And some Vietnam veteran, he said, I'm sure drove it over. And, but there's a lot of Vietnamese people here. And they're wonderful people. The kids that live across the street, they come home from school. They ride in to do their homework. They do their homework. And I want to say at about 4:30, they come outside and they play. There's a basketball hoop in front of the house. They play volleyball and they stay outside till the sun goes down. And then boom, they're inside. Saturday, they go to Vietnamese school where they learn the language and they participate in the culture. And so they're very disciplined little kids. It's very, very interesting. So I'm curious. I haven't seen the father. I'd be curious to know if he's watching. Here's another email. Mac, how did the gunner stumble onto the road to 9/11? Did he see it when it was on? Did somebody recommend it to him? I'm curious. I had never heard it till I heard you guys talking about it on the program one day. Mike, how did you stumble onto it?
I just saw an ad for it one time on TV, and I was like, oh. And I at first I thought it was kind of like going to be the same thing that's always been on TV about 9/11. And then I watched the first episode, and I realized right then and there that this was not even close to what I've seen in the past. So I was intrigued by it. And then after watching the first episode, I was captivated. It was like, wow.
And then you saw the third episode and said, I've got to share this with Mac so his head could explode?
Yeah, because I know he's an angry dude, and he'll be angrier.
Well, you know what? And the linkage between, I mean, that's what's, to me, the worst part for us as a nation is you look at the parallels between Rumsfeld, McNamara, between Bush and Kennedy, Johnson, you know, people aren't doing the right thing, people aren't standing up and when they should, and as a result, you know, let me tell you, I think General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they know history. Okay, they're right. smart guys. So the question is, trying to not get in some open-ended, protracted conflict where you have another 58,000 names. How do we support a nation, develop their military, so that allows their brand new federal organizations to kind of stand up and get some strength without costing a lot of American lives? That's not easy. Yet that has been the trick, right? I mean, look at what we've done in what we've supported in Iraq and into Syria, and with the loss of very, very few American lives. And that is, I would imagine, that will be the model for Afghanistan as well, is that the American people are not into having funerals anymore. So how do we do this with a little bit more deft hand, and how can we do it? And again, guys, we know they're smart guys and they know history. And so, but they're hard questions. So, you know, good luck to them, and I hope they do good stuff, because it's certainly watching that doesn't leave a good taste in one's mouth about our path since Vietnam, which has taken us to and out of Lebanon, to and out of Somalia, and taken us, you know, back into Iraq, right, into almost out of Afghanistan and now back in. So, you know, anyway. All right, any big plans for the weekend?
No, it's raining right now.
Yeah, I saw that.
Or, yeah.
38 degrees in Montana this morning.
I know. Winter is here.
It is. Fall's upon us. October. The next time we talk will be in October. What?
That's crazy.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's like, September's always hot. And then all of a sudden October shows up. It's like fall. What about, I was talking to the Almarine Radio head chef, and somebody sent me an email and said, hey, Mac, what kind of grill does the Gunner have? So what kind of grill do you have? We were talking about, remember growing up as a kid, right? Chicken and hot dogs would be burned black on the grill.
Right.
It took us like how many thousand years to figure out that if you only put charcoal like on half the bottom, you don't have to burn everything?
Yeah, mine is a combination of a smoker on one side and then propane on the other. And then, well, it's actually three grills in one. On the right side, it's a propane big grill. And then to the left of that is a charcoal grill. And then you put charcoal in there, same size as the other one. And then on the left side of that, down low, is a smoker grill where you put the chips and stuff in. And you open a vent, and it goes into the one in the middle, and it smokes the meat. So I got the best of both worlds. I got all three. I can do charcoal, or I can do propane, or I can smoke. So.
Wow. So that makes you a major, major league foodie, yes?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay, fine. So you can do charcoal in there, and you can do propane?
Yep.
Wow. What kind of charcoal?
Two-sipper grills.
What kind of charcoal do you use?
I use, what the hell? It's like the old charcoal. They're all rugged. They look like shit, like blocks of coal.
Okay.
Stubbs. The Stubbs charcoal. It comes like in, like bricks. Or, looks like coal, actually. I don't know why, but it's me.
And what's it made out of? Is it wood?
It's some type of wood, and it's got flavor to it. So,
what kind of flavor?
And I don't applewood, and I don't use lighter fluid. I use the little starters, you know, little.
Right.
They have no scent to them, so the meat doesn't smell like it.
Here's another email. Mac, did you see the story about a librarian in Massachusetts returning books to the First Lady because she said that Dr. Seuss books are racist? No, I haven't. You know what? We can't do anything in this country anymore. Good morning. What do you mean?
No.
Dr. Seuss, racist. Okay. Green eggs and ham. I mean, the Seuss people, they're just like weird little figures, aren't they?
Yeah, it's make-believe land.
Yeah. Okay.
There's no correlation to real life.
Yeah. You know what I say? Fire her. Fire her, librarian dumbass. You know? I'm sick of all this, political. First of all, you're a civil servant. You don't have a political opinion. Okay?
Right.
Right? You can take those books. You can ask the head librarian of the region, what should we do with these? Oh, the First Lady gave it to us? Let's put them in with all the other Dr. Seuss books that we have in our libraries. You know? So, I'm sick of it. Like the whole NFL thing. I'm sick of that. I'm sick of that stuff. Yeah. If you want to make a difference in this country, look, just walk outside and ask somebody. Hey, got any ideas how I can make a difference? Yeah. I'll tell you how. Go down to this place. You can make a difference. I'm just so sick of social media bullshit, people running their mouths but never doing anything. I'm done with that. And then civil servants, like this kind of nonsense, fire them. Okay?
Yeah.
That's what you want to express your opinion politically? That's fine. You're fired. Get out of here. Oh, but you can't fire me. Yeah, fuck you. Get out of here. I'm just sick of this shit. And it's like you can't shut it off. Again, you know what? And that's the beauty of not watching the NFL. No impact, no idea. Don't care what they do.
Right.
Have no idea what happened last night. Have no idea who won. I'm not going to watch this Sunday. I don't care. I'm done.
Yep.
I'm done with that. So anyway. All right. Now you're a free agent again. No football team. Go.
Hey,
Go Irish. Notre Dame. That's right. They play on Saturday. All right, man. Have a good weekend.
All right. I'll talk to you later, Mike.
There you go. There you go. Mike Musselman. The Gunner, interesting guy. And interesting comments growing up like Tim Lynch did in a family where you have a dad who fought in Vietnam. And Mike's dad doesn't sound like he spoke about it an awful lot. Nielsen checks in today. You two are giving me goosebumps. Will we ever tie the importance of history? And as I said, every politician in Washington should be forced to walk past the Vietnam Memorial once a month at 6 a.m. I snuck in to see the memorial at 11 p.m. when it was under construction with a Somali cab driver. Wow. Crawled under the construction fence, been back there over 100 times. Yeah, it is. It's, if you've never been, you know, when we took our family to Washington, D.C., the kids thought, well, we're going to go so Dad can see a bunch of stuff. They hadn't. When we were driving, and then we were going up to New York City for a few days. So I want to say we spent three days in D.C. and then 4 days in Manhattan. And so we were gone for about a week. And driving up to Manhattan, the kid said, I had no idea that was going to be that cool. Everything they saw. And the Vietnam Wall was part of it. They had never been there. And my kids loved Washington, D.C. You know, you can't go to, you know, you go to, for guys like us, we go to Arlington to visit people, right? People we know, people we fought with, people we medevaced and tried to save that didn't make it. You know, you go to Section 60 and you go in a period of time where you were in Iraq or Afghanistan and you can almost start on a certain date and start walking down rows and, you know, you can remember that guy and how that guy died and trying to save that guy and doing this and doing that. And their stories are all there. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing experience. And for your kids, it was very interesting to watch them see this stuff for the first time. Very, very cool. There's a few headlines. Let me point them out to you before we take a break. And again, it has my stomach in a knot, the whole thing about the Kurds. I remember Joe Biden when he was vice president. You know, he was in Iraq and he said, you know, Iraq will never be a partition, blah, blah, blah. I said, I don't know. He might not have been in Iraq. It might have been something in the United States. And so for everybody there, you know, you look like the only way Saddam held this thing together was by brute force, was by absolute positive brute force. That's how he held it together. So unless you're going to hold it together through brute force, then how do you do it? The answer is you won't be able to. You won't be able to. And so to me, I don't know, maybe what has to happen is, you know, the United States tells Turkey, do not go anywhere near the Kurdish border or the Iraqi border, or the Iraqi northern border. We won't have that. Iraq will settle its own business. And then have confidence that the Kurds will go ahead and they will defeat, or at least fight to a stalemate, the Iraqi military. And then from that stalemate comes a political solution and a revenue sharing solution that they can live with. what seems to be the best way forward for them. Because, and that's an American perspective. Let me give you an Iraqi Shiite perspective. That will never happen. We will go up there and we will destroy them. Okay. What have the Iraqis been able to do without the support of the United States? Militarily. They got their asses kicked by ISIS. They got their asses kicked all over the western part of the nation. What they can essentially do is they can defend Baghdad. And they do that with their Shiite militia and all that. Are they capable of offensive operations without United States support? And the question is, will the United States support their offensive into you know, the Kurdish homeland of northern Iraq? Good question. So here's some news headlines. U.S. carries top five on the early bird. U.S. carries out airstrikes in Libya against the Islamic State, killing several fighters. U.S. AFRICOM announced. Racial slurs written on a dorm room boards of black Air Force Academy cadet candidates. So this is an Air Force Academy prep school. Right? Some idiots go in there and write some stupid shit. So it's a high school. National news. There's audio of a Baghdadi speech. 46 minutes, evidently. But hasn't been validated that it's actually him. So we'll stand by. ISIS says it is. And there was news during the summer that he had been killed. There's a couple stories that I want you to pay attention to. One is in the Washington Examiner. Cautious State Department asks Iran and Iraq to avoid violence with the Kurds. Also, Iraq has cut off all foreign flights to Kurdish capital in Erbil. Kurds in Iraq face retaliation after independence vote. Secretary of Defense makes another unannounced stop in Qatar. Most of his stops tend to be unannounced. All right, so just real quick, headline, cautious State Department asks Iran and Iraq to avoid violence with the Kurds. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's team on Thursday discouraged Iran and Iraq from coordinating military operations against key U.S. partner in northern Iraq. Quote, we would oppose any violence if that were to take place, State Department spokesman Heather Newart said in response to reports that this kind of coordination was being considered. Quote, we hope our voices will be heard in a very strong fashion, that we oppose violence of any side of this.
Disappointing. Frankly, I think it's disgusting. It represents the men.
Gotta love those things that pop up while you're reading. She was responding to a report that Iran and Iraq may seize control of the border crossings around the semi-autonomous region of northern Iraq that is populated by Kurdish ethnic minority that plays a crucial role in the U.S.-led coalition in the defeat of the Islamic State. The tensions have risen because the Kurds voted to support breaking away from the rest of Iraq to form their own state despite opposition from Baghdad and the United States. Newart took a cautious approach to the diplomatic crisis. Quote, the United States does not want to do anything that would inflame tensions. That's why I'm going to be very cautious with my words. We will continue to offer our assistance to facilitate any dialogue if we are asked. The Iraqi central government has demanded that the Kurds relinquish control of the international airports in their territory and called on foreign governments to close any facilities in Kurdish Iraq. Quote, and this is from Ms. Newart, our relationship with the Kurds, in our view, will not change. The crisis has been escalating slowly in the years since ISIS first rampaged across northern Iraq and declared a caliphate. The official Iraqi military collapsed, but the Kurds proved effective in defending and then liberating Iraqi territory from the terrorists. That fed into latent desires for an independent Kurdistan. Such a move poses a threat to other U.S. allies such as Turkey, which has long battled against Kurdish separatist movement that could be expected to try to partner with Iraqi Kurds. Quote, look, we're friends with the Kurds. We are friends with the central government of Iraq, Nuret said. We want to have a stable, unified Iraq. We want that more than anything. It ain't happening. The only way Iraq is stable is if one tribe overtakes it and subjugates the rest. Other than that, and again, the strongest tribe, you just heard, ISIS rampages across Iraq, and where does it stop? Where does it stop? It stopped when the Kurds stopped it. So the question is, does the Iraqi military have the ass to deal with them? The short answer would be no. That if they attempt to undertake that, not good things are going to happen. This is from Bob Nielsen, so I'll end the week on this. I wrote him this morning. From Wounded Vet in Iraq, USA, Vietnamese. I'm almost afraid to ask this. Have you watched some of the series? I have, all of it, every morning. It is very, very tough, but reasonably well balanced. I think our country went insane, felt so bad the way we treated the Vietnamese, and yet when I returned in 97 to Saigon, Da Nang, Tan Ky, and even Hanoi, was treated unbelievably well. It is a tough series to watch, but God knows we needed to have it produced, and not what Hollywood and the press tells us. Please give all your family a hug for me. He wrote back, I love you, sir. Hug received. As far as watching it, I am not. I want to for my understanding of what my family went through, but only for a foundation of appreciating my family's journey. As I read through your email... What the hell was that? Where was I? I sense you have some turmoil that you are carrying around. I would like to express this to you from a soldier and American to a Marine and American. First and foremost, I appreciate the men and women that came to Vietnam to serve as it was viewed as a black hole of death. The brave that volunteer to enter a foreign country to protect and serve a country they never know. We can never speak of for all of our brothers, but we all know in every family there will be bad apples. Most of us have a decent, good moral compass and how we value life and others. Of course, that moral compass goes out of whack when we are engaging in war. We see and do things that we don't understand as life and death encounters us. You, Bob, my mentor and hero, are a very special man, a man dedicated to helping others, especially a Vietnamese-American soldier. I can tell by your actions, and then in parentheses, that's all I can judge from you. End of the parenthetical. You were an idealist in a Marine uniform, and then in parentheses, just like me, Army uniform. You were truly there to help. You, all caps, are wrong when you state, quote, I felt so bad at how we treated the Vietnamese. You can't carry that burden on your back. War, as you and I know, I don't know where that's coming from, but I'll make it not happen again. You can't carry that burden on your back. War, as you and I know, is not that clear-cut and defined. We have our lines we draw in our service branch families. My dad has always taught me, you are only an American because the U.S. came to our aid. If not, you would be a kid running in the fields. Freedom is a privilege and not a right. It can be taken from you at any moment. Bob, I will always appreciate your service and sacrifice because of men and women like you that came to my dad's country for aid. It is the reason why I joined the Army, to give back and pay my respects for those who gave me this opportunity. I love you, Bob. Thank you for your service and believing in your cause to fight. Otherwise, I wouldn't be born here as an American. It's all been worth it. A little bit different perspective. A little bit different perspective. So, that'll do it. And we'll keep turning the kaleidoscope. Obviously, not done with that subject. Because, again, it bleeds into Iraq and Afghanistan. First of all, to everybody who emailed the program, appreciate it. To people that tuned in, looking today to tune in to hear Ben Connable, we'll get him on next week as soon as he has an opening in his schedule. On Monday, Alex Hollings from SoftRep is going to join us. We'll talk to him about current events. You'll also hear Joe Dunford's confirmation hearing. You'll hear an hour on Monday, an hour on Tuesday. My thanks to, as I said, everybody who's emailed the program. Awesome stuff. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. This program repeats itself momentarily, so whatever you do, do not touch that dial. Unbelievable. It's one of those things that like goes when you have a story open and I can't find which story is open that is allowing that audio. So anyway, not that I care a whole lot. Have a great day. Have a great weekend. On a Friday, All Marine Radio, over and out. Hey, let me make one more comment. Yeah. I thought I was gone, did you? This song, The High Life, this is to all you veterans out there. Right? If you're from Vietnam, you owe it to everybody who didn't come back to live the high life, to live the good life, to do good things in their name. Because 58,000 didn't come back, and then some who came back aren't able to put their lives back together. And the same thing applies to veterans from Iraq, Afghanistan, and the war on terror. If you're looking for a cause, a reason, you know, to continue getting up, to continue living your life, that letter's a good one. Yeah, you weren't perfect. But I'm here today, and a lot of people are here today, because you came to my country. And maybe perfect is... maybe perfect's a little bit too much. Anyway, for the second time, over and out.